Hello.
Yes. Christmas. Yes. Wells, how are you doing?
I saw you.
Oh my God. I'm
there.
Feeling the feeling of Christmas. The spirit is great. 2022 is awesome. One of the most awesome years in my life.
I think that JF is riffing on the fact that I asked it to, I wanted it to be an upbeat sort of stream. I think he's taken that to heart. So anyway, welcome back to Millennial 8. I'm now here with JF Gariepi. I don't think he needs any introduction, but JF, why don't you go ahead anyway?
Yeah, I'm a scientist. I wrote The Revolutionary Phenotype, a theory that has not been debunked. I'm, of course, a host and an interviewer, although I don't do interviews anymore. I'm just hosting my small show on Odyssey at JFG tonight. And, Wells, I look at our channels. I look at your channel. I look at my channel. You know what I feel?
What?
I feel YouTube 2013.
Ah.
The same thing. It's small channels that we establish over years. We gather loyal audiences, and it's so beautiful. And we know that we're not getting interfered with.
Well, and that is wonderful. I know that you, like me, had to deal with the stress of having to get around YouTube's rules and make sure you don't cross any lines. And it's so tedious. And there's always this pressure that whatever you do, they're going to ban you anyway. So you always know the hammer could fall at any time. It's awful. Awful. You know, when I was, I've said this before, up until 2017, I really felt that I had the best job in the world. I felt so lucky. I loved it. I couldn't believe that I was able to make my living from doing this, you know, talking about society, talking about culture, talking about psychology and so on. And then it turned into really the worst. Well, I'm not going to say it's the worst job in the world, but it turned into a real dirge and something that was very psychologically taxing, this constant feeling that at any time they could just take it all away.
It's very hard to express. Most people will not go through this, but waking up every morning knowing that you could have lost all your jobs and you don't have a safety net, because I can't get employed at the grocery store. Once I went to YouTube, I sacrificed everything for it. And you have to, because if you don't sacrifice everything for it, you stay anonymous. You may not be monetized as fast. You're not going to grow an audience. So in my view, it was, okay, I'm jumping down the plane and I'm becoming a YouTuber. And that's the last thing I'll ever do. And when you are in that situation, losing your monetization can be a very dark thing. Now, another thing I noticed looking at your channels, each of the thumbnails contain different trees in the background from a different camera view. You've been playing in a plane simulator, a 3D virtual space of some kind, Millennial Wells, haven't you?
No, those are renders from a 3D landscape that I built up. It's the one that you see in the intro, and I took high resolution renders at different camera angles off it, and then the program randomly selects one of those and a section from it and uses that as the background for each thumbnail. So it's
exactly what I was thinking. You've been spending time in a virtual space. I'm here to connect you back with reality.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Now, I did ask JF, as I said at the start, that this is going to go out on Christmas Eve. In Europe, on the continent, this is actually the day that they celebrate. It's not tomorrow, which I don't quite understand. But either way, this is a special night for everyone. So I didn't want this to be a sort of depressing stream. Now, obviously, that means that the people you select have to... Well, I don't know about Antidem. We'll see how it goes with him. But either way, I want this to be quite a nice stream. And now, I said this to JF, and he has selected a bunch of news stories, events from this year, and he thinks they point in a good direction. So thank you for agreeing to do this, JF. I should say, everyone should subscribe to JF's Odyssey channel. I watch his streams regularly. They're very informative, very well thought out, and there's a nice, cozy atmosphere, which I think is just very special. It's lovely when you find a channel that is like that. And obviously, I've known JF's channel for years, but this particular format, I think, is very nice. So,
now, to talk about why we celebrate on the 24th, that is something that I was doing when I was young. It's that our parents were bringing us on the 24th of the night at midnight. We were going to the church so that we could see the Christmas Day come in. And the Christmas Day was coming at midnight precisely. Then we were all going back home from the church village, from the church village. And we were headed back home. And then we were opening the gifts sometimes at 1, 2 a.m. in the morning. Sometimes people were going to sleep and were opening them in at the 25th. So that is why we were celebrating on the 24th. And it's a vacation day for most workers, so there was space to do it and space also to celebrate the next day, going to one family or the other or that kind of stuff.
I see. Okay, well, thank you for that explanation. All right, so let's get started with the year's event, since that is what generally happens on Millennial. And I think that you have put together a thesis as to this all bodes well for us. So what was the, actually, could you copy the list of things into the private chat here, so that I know the itinerary?
Absolutely. So the first thing that strikes me from this year is the Ukraine war. So when I think of 2018 to 2021, I see the rise of the psyops, the rise of the deep state, and the rise of a mechanism of control of people that we've never seen before, really. We have never had a case, we've had vaccine intimidation before, but we've never had a case where the entirety of society almost was participating to it and was bound by the state to participate to it. So we had the businesses shut down. We had the businesses becoming the new police to impose masks and vaccines. We had the schools impose it on children. And we had the social media that had successfully developed a censorship system, a kind of industrialized system of censorship that made possible the rise of Ukrainian warmongering, pro-Ukrainian warmongering, without it being called out by almost anyone of notice, in the sense that there was 2-3 journalists maybe who still had Twitter account that could call out the bullshit, the pro-Ukrainian warmongering bullshit from the FBI and CIA that operate bots on Twitter. Now we know. So it was a dark era, this 2018 to 2021, a very dark era. But in 2022, we had the Ukraine war start. We had a different positioning suddenly displayed by Putin, which has always been in the background, this kind of opposition to Western civilization, but not from a place of third worldism, not from a place of Asian civilization, but from a place of a country of white people that have actually kept true the propaganda. They have kept their own demographics, and they are still as much Russian today as they were before. Now, they have there's some defects about Putin, but still he rose as a figure that would oppose the Western liberal regime and that would start picking out at critiques that can be done to liberalism and to LGBT activism. So I think it's a massive red pill for a lot of people to see a man in power, even if he's smeared, even if the media goes after him. When you talk to regular farmers where I live, you know, people who live very far from big cities, they will take you in secret and they will put you on the side and they will say, you know what, Jeff, I've seen these news about Ukraine. And I think that Putin is not that bad. And just to have this opposition to Western civilization that is born outside of us, it's beautiful because it puts our whole system of psyops and control of our population on the watch. And now they are being criticized from outside to someone they can't really do anything about.
that is true. And he's sort of Teflon in a way. He just keeps going because it doesn't really matter. This is I saw a meme at one point that it was two Russian soldiers saying, "You know what really worries me? That we're losing the information war." And the joke was that the information war doesn't actually matter unless you care about such things. If there's an actual war on the ground, then people can say it's just all talk. It's just drivel, really.
And actually, I would argue it was perfect that they won the information war so that it would get exposed to everyone how useless it is. Because the Ukrainians had been deceived into thinking that, oh yeah, you can do anything with social media. Look at what the Twitter of Jack Dorsey had done with the Arab Spring. It had risen as an option to promote basically an anti-regime positioning into Arab countries. But the fact is, you can do this against a weak regime in a population that's already ready to take it in. You can't do this to an actual army. And this is what Putin has demonstrated, the great weakness of NATO and of the alliance, showing that, yes, with a relatively second world type of economy, like Mexico size economy, you can give great trouble to NATO. And because you can win the war on the ground, it really doesn't matter that they have nuclear missiles because they're not going to use them.
So are you confident that Russia is going to win the war in Ukraine?
Of course, there's no winning a war like this. It's a war of attrition and a war of tiring the other side. So there's not going to be a victory in the sense of an overtake of the full part of all of Ukraine. The Ukraine below Poland, the western part of Ukraine, seems safe to me, and I think it's going to stay that way. But they won because within a few days, basically, a country has been successful at chopping one-fifth of Ukraine, basically, and they are still standing there. And those territories that were demographically Russian and politically Russian, they have shown that if you preserve the demographics of a section of your country, that demographics will eventually segregate, will eventually separate from that country, even inside a war, even when it's an other country that comes to intervene. You can make parallels and think in all sorts of positive ways about the U.S. What will happen when the U.S. gets broken down? What happens with central parts of the U.S. filled with white people, Republicans, with a sense of farming and property and a sense of European civilization, it makes you dream.
Yeah. Are you thinking about Idaho, Montana, perhaps seceding?
Exactly. Seceding or, DPR, LPR in Ukraine tried seceding, but it wasn't the seceding that made it work. It was the support from outside coming from Russia. So let's not be deceived into thinking the only political option is one where we go to vote, and there will be troubles in upcoming civilization, and we will be able to exploit these troubles in all sorts of ways, just like the Russian ethnics of Ukraine were able to exploit this conflict, which was ultimately a conflict between Russia and NATO. That's the ostensible statement about it. But really, ethnicities have succeeded at pulling the best out of it, and that's beautiful. Despite, of course, the human suffering that is inherent to all this and the disgusting behavior of Zelensky, who's cynically draining money from the U.S., increasing the suffering of his own people. But all of this is also being seen and constituting a future red pill, I think. The same way I had predicted before COVID, I had said the medical experts will discredit themselves, and eventually it's going to build into a red pill. I think that 2022 was the build up to where we can finally appreciate that red pill, because 2020, 2021, with the censorship and everything, we had a resistance against medical fascism, but that resistance was a fringe movement. Now it's a mainstream thing, and a lot of things for which people were banned 2 years ago are now truths established, and you'll hear them at CNN.
Oh, yeah, and in a related thing, I saw that yesterday, and I meant to save it, but I didn't, a screenshot of a tweet, I can't remember who it was, and they were saying that the term conspiracy theorist was invented by the CIA to cover up the JFK assassination, and now they've basically admitted that they killed JFK.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
Yes, I had an interview of Ryan Dawson, who I think has been the very early expert on this question, because what has been learned in the last few weeks, he was telling it on my show 2 or 3 years ago. Ryan Dawson is really the expert, and he knows about these documents. And yes, it seems that basically the PSYOP deep state system of thought control in the US is so powerful that they basically choose whether the president will be working in their advantage. And if he isn't, they can, as they did with JFK, kill him. In the case of Trump, what they tried doing is a PSYOP through the media more, and kind of an eternal smearing with 14 different women claiming that he had raped them or sexually assaulted them. Those are the tools that this group constantly uses.
It is amazing. I mean, we saw this with Kavanaugh as well, of course, that a bunch of women, and it later turned out to be fraudulent, but they put him through the ringer. They did as much damage to him as they possibly could. And I can't even remember what the stakes actually were. Was he going to be put on the Supreme Court?
He was going to be put anyway, but it was the hearings for basically the Senate to pass him. And the Republicans would vote him in anyway. But the Democrats decided we can do damage, we can do psychological damage, the same way they did with Clarence Thomas. Absolutely disgusting. And he presented it in a very powerful speech as a lynching. And that is what it is. They want to psychologically weaken you. But I think there's so much, and this is why 2022 is beautiful, is I think it's becoming a normified idea. The fact that you don't have to kneel to this crap, that you can self-cancel, you can self-immolate, and maybe we can move on to Ye, which is my second subject of 2022, because that's exactly what he did. He told the normies, look, you can do something that will result in your smearing, but the real you will pop out at the end, out of all this crap, all of all these lawsuits and all these cancellations. The real you is what will be left at the end, and it's a beautiful thing.
Well, let's get to the matter of Kanye then, or Ye, Kanye West. Because that obviously is a big story, and I'm a bit disappointed that it hasn't featured more on Millennial this year. I thought it would, but well, how to approach this? It's a dodgy topic. But basically, what we have here is a black rapper, extremely rich and famous, who turned against the network of Jews that he felt were oppressing him. And, you know, it has happened before. I think it was Public Enemy in the late 80s. I've forgotten the guy's name. But he claimed that there were Jews in control of the music industry. I believe it's happened in other times as well, other examples, but I don't know what they are. But Kanye West is clearly massively more high profile than anyone who's previously said this. And he's pretty absolutist about it. I mean, he's not being subtle or nuanced about it. He's being very in your face. And, well, you go for it, Jia.
Well, yeah, I think that what is awakening people to is this kind of culture of handling. And I think it doesn't just happen to very rich people. I think very rich people like him will have a dedicated handler. But I think everyone can kind of see how presidents are being handled. We can see Trump. We can see Jared Kushner. We can see that there's always some manager, not so far, that seems to be the main beneficiary in a way and the main controller of what happens. And I could see it myself trying to invite people back in the public space days. I was looking for guests. I would get a Steven Pinker. Steven, you know, I'm a PhD in neuroscience. He knows me. You want to come on my show? I'd like to talk about your recent book about the alt-right or whatever. And yeah, I would get an answer from him. Yes, Jeff, I'll go on your show. Let's talk about it. I like to be challenged and everything. But then there would be some agent, some scheduler, some lawyer coming in and saying, oh yeah, we're not going to answer your emails anymore. Like, there's always a handler around to keep the actual genuine thing from happening. And the genuine thing has been from Ye a message of Jesus Christ is Lord, a very American Christian message. And typically the people who go that hard into Jesus Christ and Lord, they will be awakened one day or another toward the Jewish question. Some of them will choose to shut up about it, but Ye took the different path and said, no, I'm going to talk about it. Now it has transformed in kind of clownish performances at different moments where he does the apology of public figures that would be illegal to do the apology of in Canada. But he's done it, and in a way, it's very liberating. I think that it gave the occasion to Dave Chappelle bringing it on SNL. This is massive amounts of exposure for IDs that are extremely red-pilling, because once you understand the problem of handling, the problem of management, and the problem that what you see on the public space is not the real thing, that something behind is happening. As long as we have this kind of divorce between the reality that is shown and the reality that is controlling, we can't get to truth, we can't get to fairness, and we certainly can't get to an awakening of white people about the state of their society. So yeah, here, divorce, he clashes all the barrier, and he says it's going to be reality from now on. And to the Lex Fridman that are interviewing him in dishonest fashion, he says, still, what I said is true. What is the problem? And Ye has the additional leverage that we may not have, that he's a black man. And there's been so much promotion of black suffering, the black subjective experience in the last few years. How can they today tell us that we shouldn't listen to the black subjective experience?
Well, absolutely. And this is one of the main things about it, that it violates the dynamic that we're supposed to believe in, that black people are the bottom of the victim hierarchy, and they therefore can complain about anyone else in society because anyone else is necessarily above them in the hierarchy, and therefore not as credible. Because we're taught to believe in this idea of the victim hierarchy. That, you know, the lower you are, then the more credible you are. It's a silly, it's a retarded notion, of course, but it is what we have been encouraged to believe in. So now that is being used against certain people.
And let's not forget how it all started. Ye wearing a White Lives Matter shirt. And by simply saying that his fellow whites mattered to him, maybe just as much as black lives, and I think it should be the case. I think it's unquestionable that the Constitution should protect white people as much as it protects black people. But the mere doing of this let all of the managers expose themselves and come out of the woodworks and start the cancel culture process against him. And we had some beautiful moments in this episode where Greenblatt from the ADL comes in and says, oh yeah, we had to take him out, you know, or the myth would have spread. Basically doing exactly what Ye is reproaching to them, which is you're acting like a manager, like a social engineer. You want to play with the public space to project a deceptive image to the European people. And that won't pass anymore. This was such a big hit on the structure of dishonesty and censorship. I think it's one of the most beautiful events in my whole life.
I would say that in terms of it being funny, a funnier thing happened last year, which was that the French general on TV in France with, what was his name, Claude Pasternak? I can't remember now.
I don't remember his name.
That was absolutely hilarious. One of the funniest things I've ever seen. Yeah, Claude Pasternak. Absolutely, this was the infamous key. Oh, Oh, God, it was one of the... I remember seeing it and thinking, this is a classic moment. People are going to talk about this for years and years. And I had the pleasure of introducing a friend to it who hadn't seen it yet. And I said to him, this is one of the funniest things you'll ever see in your life.
Now, I've been wondering about this clip. How do English people approach it? Do you guys understand that key means who?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And I was always worried. Yeah.
Well, I saw a subtitled version. I mean, I guess I could actually play it. What do you think?
Oh, you can if you want. I mean, your choice.
I think it's a fitting thing to just include, even though it was from last year. It was so funny. Let me just check if this is the version. I actually have three versions of it. Oh, no, it's not that. That's a joke version.
Okay. While you find this, I can say that this clip is basically the result of many years of work by two French intellectuals, Dieudonné and Alain Soral, who have been awakening the French people to through an alternative culture, through YouTube, through various shows that they've organized. They've been awakening the French people to this question. And I'm sure that this general is a fan of either Alain Soral or Dieudonné.
Okay. This I'll just play it. It's from July last year, apparently. But it's relevant to the Kanye West. It serves as a sort of prequel, a very low-budget prequel to the Kanye West thing. So here you go. This is a French general being interviewed on French TV. I think a retired general. Here we go. Okay.
Donc j'ai une question à vous poser, puisque vous parlez dans les médias, mais vous parliez dans les médias avant de parler dans des médias comme Valeurs Actuelles. Vous avez fait différentes interviews, et en particulier dans la tribune diplomatique internationale. Et dans la tribune diplomatique internationale, on vous posait la question de savoir si les élections avaient été truquées aux États-Unis. Et je vais lire votre réponse pour éclairer un petit peu de qui vous êtes, puisque vous n'arrêtez pas de dire que vous êtes ni LR, ni FN, ni etc. C'est-à-dire, vous essayez de faire passer auprès des Français l'idée que vous êtes apolitique. Donc je vais essayer de répondre pour éclairer les Français sur la nature de l'émetteur que vous êtes. Donc on vous pose la question, la tribune diplomatique internationale, l'hypothèse d'une fraude importante appliquée à quelques États clés le jour du scrutin est-elle crédible ? On parle des États-Unis. Mon intime conviction me dit que oui. Car il y a à mes yeux trop d'indices concordants pour permettre à la meute médiatique occidentale, dont nous savons qui la contrôle, de me convaincre du contraire. Donc j'ai une question à vous poser. Qui contrôle la meute médiatique?
J'ai bien envie de savoir également.
Général de la Warde.
Vous savez bien. Qui contrôle la meute médiatique dans le monde et en France? Qui contrôle le Washington Post? Qui contrôle le New York Times? Qui contrôle chez nous BFM TV et tous les journaux qui viennent se grouper autour?
Qui parlez de Dreyfus, monsieur? Qui?
Ben c'est la communauté que vous connaissez bien.
Mon Dieu.
Ah non, ben alors là on va pas partir là-dessus. On va arrêter là, mon général. Honteux. Je suis désolé, on peut pas laisser dire ça sur l'antenne.
Voilà pourquoi
je suis désolé. Non, on arrête là. On coupe, s'il vous plaît, on enlève le général. Voilà, merci, on coupe, on peut pas continuer là-dessus.
You didn't even say it. Why would you ask a question if you don't want the answer?
The thing is, you can see the guy literally shaking with rage, trembling while he's asking the question. It goes on and on. There were so many funny memes that arose from this. But the other thing is, I love how you can, when the general says it's a community that you know well, you can hear a woman off screen saying, "Mon Dieu." Absolutely brilliant. And then, of course, they just cut it. They just took it off air. Yes. So that, I'm so glad that somebody managed to record it at the time. And that was
the reason it's a substance to celebrate this year is we wouldn't have ever known 3 or 4 years ago that we were that these ideas would reach mainstream discussion levels, where a rich person like Ye decides to go that way, and there is much to celebrate. And of course, there's the Nick Fuentes involvement in all this, which obviously he's been having a very positive effect on Ye, and he's been working his discourse. He's been polishing him. And I think that much of what we hear from Ye now comes from the mind of Nick Fuentes.
Yeah, I wondered about that, and also about the involvement of Milo. I don't know, you've not had any involvement with Milo, as far as I know. I actually did chat to him very briefly last year, and he was going to appear on Millennial last year, but it didn't happen. And I think, I mean, I have no idea what to think about the guy, to be honest. But I suspect this was mainly for him a chance at regaining prestige and fame in society. I think that's what was going on here.
And I'm having very positive words for Nick Fuentes, but I mean, I still consider him on my blacklist, but I talk about him on the news, but just because he attacked me and my family and did some very bad comments about me. But putting this on the side and objectively analyzing, I think he did a massive 6D chess on Milo. I think that Milo basically can be easily recognized by someone who has internet culture as someone who is too parasitic, who is trying to always surf on fame waves that are not justified. And he will just connect himself to any fame wave to try to rise a little more. And Nick Fuentes probably has a greater plan, a greater political plan than this. And so he kicked him out when he could. He played friend with Milo. We saw them in an interview that was uncomfortable to the point where I was feeling that there may have been something homosexual linking the two at some point. But no, it turns out I was wrong, and that Nick was just getting close to Milo to up himself in the game. And once he had what he wanted, which is he unlocked a contact with Ye, he proved to Ye that the best thing to do was to get rid of Milo, and that was absolutely beautiful. The ultimate reason why it happened, it is said that Milo wanted to kick Nick out, that he saw Nick was taking too much space in intellectualizing Ye, and Milo, of course, doesn't have this kind of drive. He's not really interested at making a political revolution, is mostly interested at draining the celebrity status that comes with it. And eventually Nick won. And Nick won in the head of Ye, which is quite spectacular, that Ye had the sense of, okay, he's the right one to team with, not the other one.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And what Nick Fuentes, what do you... And, you know, I fell out with him a long time ago as well. So we've both had a similar experience there. I think that, well, a lot of people fall out with him, but, you know, whatever. I'm not making a criticism here. I think it's just something that goes with people who are very driven, you might say sociopathic. They've got that sort of ruthlessness. But what do you think is his plan? Do you think that he's going to eventually make a play for real American politics?
He may. I think that Nick Fuentes thinks of himself as a political strategist. Now, in my view, he's not going to succeed. The system of politics in the U.S. is highly impenetrable. So I don't think it's going to lead to anything. But I think we can interpret his behavior as always act as if there was a possibility. And perhaps he believes genuinely in that possibility inside his heart. But I think that the rational analysis here forces us to recognize that you cannot mix cancel culture and a rise to mainstream politics in the U.S. You have to do one or the other. Personally, I chose cancel culture. He seems to have always been hopping between the two and kind of benefiting in his super chats and his large audience support from the fact that he gives the illusion of being on a straight political path with a political project. You have to give him credit. He's done amazing things in 2022. But whether that leads anywhere, my black-pilled view is to say no.
Right, okay. I remember people saying that he was finished 2 years ago. And I think people said it again this time last year. And I suspect people were saying it 3 years ago as well. because it has at various times been sort of farcical and shambolic, the AF situation, different figures in it. There is a general sense of immaturity, the whole incel thing, and
yes,
the anarchic Zoomer humor. It's all sarcastic and cynical and all this. So you never know quite what to make of it. And it's somewhere where I do feel sort of over the hill. You know, I just don't get it. You know, it's too weird for me. But at the same time, there is a definite drive in that crowd, but especially in Nick Fuentes himself, which I think is why they gravitate to him, why the crowd revolves around him, because he is this, very sort of electric guy.
Yes.
But I, as you say, that doesn't necessarily translate to anything in the actual world of politics. And I'm not saying this as to do him down. I'm just trying to be realistic. But of course, we're talking about American politics as it is today. American politics as it is today is extremely controlled, extremely boring, and dominated by old men. And this seems to be something that has been the case for decades. American presidents tend to be in their 60s or 70s. You don't get dynamic people being prominent in American politics. Remember with the Iraq War, it was Donald Rumsfeld who looked like this sort of dead zombie, heavy and very heavy face, and lifeless eyes and all that. And that's typical. And then you get some idiot. I don't need to name names. They're just American politicians who you don't know what they're even doing. What's the point? What are you hoping to achieve? It's just bullshit. It's a runaround. I would like very much. You could say the similar thing about Britain, although it's more of a, like, there are younger politicians, than in America, but they're equally unadventurous and staid and controlled. I would like this to change in Britain and in America and everywhere. Do you think that, and this is relevant to Nick Fuentes, do you think that while he's incompatible with the American political culture as it is today, do you think that might change? And do you think that he actually himself could change that? Do you think he has the force of character to usher in a new era?
Well, I think there is a place you can dream, basically. You can dream of a future. But the problem is the only way I see it getting there historically is a couple of decades and to attain a post-white America. In a post-white America, it's blacks, Hispanics, Jews, Italians of New York. All of these are becoming gangs. And there's even the white gang.
Gangs, mobs, and coincidences.
Yes. So if you think of that future America, it's a sad America to think about because it's one in which white people have no more power or just as a minority. But in that position of minority, we could see the theme of, hey, is it really fair that, for example, the Jewish community would force onto the black community a sense of guilt for the Holocaust? And in that America, with someone like Ye and with people like Nick Fuentes, perhaps you can have them rise and perhaps you can have the base black man rise in from the depth of Chicago and kind of like the Ubermensch of Nietzsche. The base black man rises and becomes a thing in America. I can think of this, yes.
That is not quite what I was expecting. I was meaning Nick Fuentes himself to be a figure in America.
The politics. Thing is, I think that Nick Fuentes will be old by the time we reach that stage. So I think that Nick Fuentes will always be regarded as a man of the internet, of the fringe. I don't think he's going to unlock normie potential late in life. I think he's going to be too old by the time this event that I described can happen.
Yeah, and there is also that his appeal is youthful. I don't know, you know, you get this with pop stars where you just can't be that. When you're in your 40s, you can't behave as if you're in your 20s. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't seem right. And his personality is very, you know, he comes across like a teenager.
That's the whole the marketing of Nick Fuentes is all based around this femboy idea of him looking basically like an undeveloped human being who never saw testosterone.
That's one way to say it. I think. Well, the other question is, what about Kanye West? What about Ye? Now, by the way, I'll mention again, and I put up a Telegram post about it at the time. I really liked your analysis of his appearance on Tim Pool. And I hope that everyone goes and sees that. It was very good. It's linked on my Telegram. Even if you're not interested in this story, JF's analysis of it is interesting from a psychological point of view. It shows the dynamics between these men in a very brief window. I mean, the whole thing lasts, I think, 21 minutes. 21 and a half minutes. It's tiny, really. But there's actually a lot going on even in that time. It's a very interesting video that JF did. But what about the long term? I mean, this is what interests me. What's going to become of Kanye West now after this? Has he basically destroyed his career, his wealth, his fame, his reputation?
Yes,
and is he now irrelevant, or is he going to have a new life, or what? What do you predict?
No, I think that there is a place for Kanye West in the future for Ye, but I don't think it's a place of success as a president. I think he can still do music, you know, and he can be a self-publisher of music in the current context. And he's going to draw a lot of attention to his music. So he's done exactly the right thing to be living endlerless. Now, that doesn't translate into normie political support. It doesn't translate also one thing that they don't have is a political machine. You need a political machine to win the current elections in the US and probably forever, because it's all the game of you go knock at people's door, you bring them to the voting booth, or you bring them the famous mail-in ballots, and you basically fill it for them because they're too stupid. That's what you have to do to win an election in the US. And I don't see Kanye being able to deploy his army of, you know, Kanye has visions of energy and energetic community and very woo-woo stuff that you can see him talk about sometimes. But these visions are not sufficient to produce the machine. The machine is produced by corruption, and the masters of corruption are the Democrats. And you need a lot of money. You need to shower poor people with money. That is the game of the election in the US. Now, where I see a place for Kanye in the future is he's still a creator. He's been closing a lot of doors. He's still a creator. He still can do music, and his music will have some amount of audience. And most importantly, there may be the rise of a kind of culture of cancel culture, a post-cancel culture type of society where we look at people of the past, perhaps like even you and I and someone like Ye, and we kind of consider them the generals of an army and the early warning signs, the early whistleblowers, and we kind of see their canceling of themselves as medals of honor that they are carrying on their vest. In that kind of culture, if it develops, Kanye would be just one of the OGs of it.
That's an interesting concept. Somebody once said to me that all of this stuff that we have done will be remembered in some way. I'm not sure. I'm really not. And someone said it recently, actually. Several people said about Millennial that it serves as a sort of record of discourse and the ideas that were floating around in 2018 and 2020 and 2022. And so that's there for posterity. And that's a really nice idea. I hope it's true.
I think it's true. I'm an archivist, by the way. Before being a YouTube celebrity, my fascination was to just gather information from the early internet and information from BBSs and retaining the culture of the computer world. And I've been reading stuff from people on their computer in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. I was also researching old scientists and lost manuscripts that they had written. And sometimes I would find something from a respiratory physiologist in the 18th century. And I would be like, holy shit, this guy was seeing stuff that we got to understand after. We always leave a trace, and it's impossible for everything to disappear. The censorship has been harsh, and it's making things disappear, but there's always someone out there being an autistic collector of anything, and he's collecting the millennials right now.
Oh, that's a nice thought. All right, so Kanye West, I think we've said all we need to say about that. So let's get now to Sam Bankman-Fried and the FTX scandal. Now, I had Horace on a few nights ago who talked about this in depth. I think it's like an hour and a half long, because this is something that I think baffles a lot of people. So actually, you are unlike a lot of people, you are still optimistic about the world of crypto, aren't you?
Absolutely. Is the time to buy Bitcoin, so buy Bitcoin. The price may go a little lower, but don't worry about it. Just buy Bitcoin with the idea of selling in 2-3 years. That's what I do. It's not a professional expert comment. It's really just what I do. I think that the Bitcoin waves of bull run have been demonstrated. They happen around each halvings, and I don't see any reason why Bitcoin is not any more relevant. In fact, in many ways, it's more relevant to society than ever. I think Bitcoin has more impact on normie economy than anyone wants to acknowledge at this point. I think I'm the only one suggesting that right now the real estate market is breathing at the rate of Bitcoin halvings. The real estate market went very high during the big Bitcoin peak, and now it's dropping. To me, that's evidence that now Bitcoin is driving enrichment. Bitcoin is proposing a model that counters the Fed's action and makes them invalid and useless. Bitcoin will have massive impact still on the economy that's to come. Not that has already existed, but that's to come. The future is all around Bitcoin. So you can still reserve some for yourself at very low prices compared to what the future will look like.
That's a really good message. And I do have this feeling as well. I mean, I think your analysis of it is more, analytical. I'm working on an intuition that this is something that is stable and reliable in a way that fiat currencies are not. Stable might not be the right word, because obviously the value fluctuates, but still it is a reflection of something real. Whereas fiat currency can be manipulated by the central banks. We know that that's kind of the whole point of it. It's what they've been doing for decades. So I can imagine that in an era of instability, which I think is to come in the world, Bitcoin especially, and other cryptos, but especially Bitcoin, could serve as something secure, something reliable, something certain, in a world where possibly all other currencies will be bullshit.
Absolutely.
So I would, you know, I'm not certain about this, and I'm not telling anyone to risk your life savings on it, but I am saying I'm not pessimistic about the world of crypto. I think it does have a future. We're kind of in a way we're sort of past the point at which it couldn't have a future. I think this goes even for the Kanye story as well. We're past the point at which that could be suppressed completely. It's the same with multiculturalism in general. All of these things, we're now past the point of the regime being able to suppress things in the way that it once could, like 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So in a way, I just feel like crypto is something whose time has come. So I suspect it does have a future, regardless of what they'll do to mess it around and suppress it. And actually, just on that matter, I should say that the Millennial NFT is finally ready and it's up for auction. And I hope that people do bid on it. It's there now. The link will be in the live chat. It's in the description. So maybe consider that. I wonder if the millennial NFTs will be valuable in the future. I don't know. But at any rate, there's something unique. It's there's one
I'm
each
giving
year.
Them, I'm yeah. giving them 100% chance of being higher value than a regular ape NFT.
Thank you for that word of encouragement there. But they are something unique that you can own. So there we go, millennial.com/NFT. Now, that brings us to the story of, rather paradoxically, the story of FTX. And I think it's important to say that, in actual fact, the failure of FTX is not a reflection of crypto itself. It's really people. It's people being fraudsters. And, you know, we've heard about others in the past who did it in the world of fiat currency. So anyway, JF, you take it. Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX.
Yeah, so I think this story has a huge red-pilling potential for a lot of people because it's a subject that is purely economic, so we're not talking about control of the media. But as you properly pointed out, it's not an efficiency, a lack of, it's not a problem of crypto, what happened. It's a problem of normie economy trying to do crypto, trying to look like crypto. And what we ultimately have is the classical case of someone selling fake something. And you have this in the gold market. You have paper gold. You know, they don't really sell you gold. They sell you, okay, we owe you that much gold. And that is the paper market, and it rises on anything. And it's really anti-BTC in its philosophy. Because the whole idea of BTC was to say there will not be a paper BTC. And yet, SBF, coming from a nepotistic, typical background of Democrats, academics, his two parents were academics. He was himself into the whole nepotism of the school system of the U.S., those big schools. His girlfriend he met at his school. They come from a math, physics, economics background, so probably brilliant in some way, but also deeply immoral, and they don't live with this obligation of, hey, we are keeping people's fund. We have a fiduciary duty. And so just like all these fraudsters that have done before him, just like Bernard Madoff, he was taking money from people, making bets with it on the market that he wasn't telling the people about, and ultimately violating his fiduciary duty toward his depositors for self-enrichment. Because if you can win that bet, if you can win that bet without telling it to your depositors, you become a billionaire multiple times. You become super rich. But when you lose that bet, your depositors ask for withdrawals and you have nothing to give them. So that is a violation of Bitcoin principle. And the most amazing thing, probably the most red-pilling thing, is how people are seeing through it. There's no one in the mainstream arguing Bitcoin is deeply problematic. Even the big supporters of SBF and FTX are recognizing, okay, this was a human fraud on a human process that was the buying of paper BTC. Ultimately, BTC is not to be ashamed of anything in this. BTC performed extremely well through this, and it will keep delivering the decentralized option that precisely is designed to avoid people like SBF. So I think that we are entering an era where, you know, the early Bitcoiners would keep telling you, not your keys, not your coin. I think people are going to start taking this extremely seriously in the future. And now we have tools. We have metal plates to keep your seed words. We have hardware wallets that are impenetrable. You literally need to physically push a button to send Bitcoins. And that's beautiful because now Bitcoin is coming out of the software world and we have these basically physical manifestations of Bitcoin coming into reality. On top of it, it's kind of a demonstration, this whole FTX story, of the toxicity of the Democrat leftist academic circles in the US, and that ultimately, even with a very successful thing like crypto, they couldn't do anything with it. They ridiculed themselves by recommending that people send their money to this guy who was absolutely dishonest. And some people have been exposed through this, some YouTubers who were basically sold out to promote FTX. They have been exposed. Sam Harris inviting SBF on his own podcast rather than inviting actual intellectuals. Oh, why not invite someone from my own tribe and promote them? Well, you promote a fraud. That's what you do.
Yeah. And well, Sam Harris, I think, has just disgraced himself in numerous ways over the last few years. Because there is now his infamous comment about, what was it? He said something about
dead children in the basement.
yeah. As long as it keeps Trump out of the White House, was that? Yeah.
Yeah. He said, "I don't care. I wouldn't care if Hunter Biden had dead children in the basement. I would still vote for Joe Biden."
Right.
The amazing. Same guy who will criticize everything that is done by Trump's children. It's not like he has this moral principle that a father shouldn't be attacked for his children. He's doing it to Trump. So clearly, he just hates Trump deep in his gut.
And this is an interesting thing about Trump. You know, I believe that because some people think, well, he's in on it. Trump is part of the whole game and all that. I think he is in some ways and has been in the past and all that. But today, in this day and age, I think that he is quite genuinely, he's enough of an outsider that the insiders hate him viscerally and passionately. And I think that is real. I don't think that's put on for show. For some reason, I mean, I don't even know why they hate him so much, because he, as we saw in his 4 years in the White House, he was completely ineffectual. But I think it's more of a symbolic thing. Same with Brexit. You know, it's that he isn't our guy. He won't do anything. He won't damage us, but he isn't our guy. And therefore, it's outrageous for him to be in power.
Yeah, it is. It is basically paranoia at a sub-threshold than the clinical one. And you have schizophrenia that leads you to have all these hallucinations. But I deeply think that schizophrenia is an extreme expression of something that goes on in the population, that basically we are paranoid politically. That is the human animal. That is who we are. And the same way a deer, you know, will see just any sort of light and just run away, or hear any sort of noise and just run away. You can accuse the deer of being paranoid. Perhaps the noise wasn't dangerous, but then your ancestors have had so many instances where just these little words were building up into political systems that would eventually oppress you, that the leftists are stuck with this kind of paranoia that is beside reality, but that is inspired from past trauma. And the great past trauma, of course, that motivates the leftists is authoritarianism, far-right authoritarianism, religion, and the Holocaust, basically. Those are their pillars of self-identity.
Yeah, those are the things they rail against and which propel them to do what the destruction that they wreak every single day. I think also patriarchy would be a big one. I mean, you could say also the other things like slavery, but I think that's a bit too distant for, I mean, you know, it's not something that's in people's minds, but they have this fear. Certainly the Holocaust, for obvious reasons. They're demented with it. But yeah, to get back to the FTX scandal, is there anything else that you would want to say about that? And what
no,
proves,
that's pretty
what
much
it.
Big red pilling potential, just like the other events, and so many details in it that are hilarious. Just the girlfriend of SBF and how SBF ultimately is now getting betrayed by her, and she looks so special. That's all I will say.
Yeah, she's not what you would choose as a sort of billionaire trader. You probably wouldn't expect to end up with a girl like that.
You can see in his dating choices that he knew he wasn't really a billionaire. You knew the fraud was in from the beginning.
Okay. All right. So the next one is big story, the Twitter acquisition by Elon Musk. I've talked about this numerous times. I think it was first touted in May Then there was the whole thing about, oh, it's not worth as much as they're claiming. It's bots. Then, and that the deal was off. And then I think about October, it suddenly, or September, it was suddenly announced that the deal was back on. They were going to take him to court and about reneging on the deal. Then suddenly the deal was back on. And then suddenly Twitter was his and it belonged to him. So do you want to take us through that story?
Yeah, simply a story that has generated a lot of hope. A story that is disappointing in many ways. I'm still not back on Twitter. I don't know about you. Have you been unbanned? So disappointing on the result. But I would argue there's still something positive to be seen throughout this. First, even if we never get unbanned, I think that Twitter eventually will fail. All social media eventually becomes this super boomer thing that is almost cringe to think about. And it comes faster than most people would think. I mean, Facebook at this point has really this boomer feeling to it. Even the things that Trump started, Truth Social, Parler, they feel very boomerish. And so things can go very quick. So I would say, let us not be too disappointed if we never get unbanned by Twitter, because it just confirms that we belong in a fringe, honestly talking, honestly thinking group of people that are so exceptional, really, that even the tolerant and open Elon cannot be open to that degree, or that even him is handled still too much for us to be liberated. If that's how I have to live the rest of my life, I'm fine with it. And I will still be on Odyssey streaming and laughing at the fall of Twitter in 2, 3, 5 years, whatever it is. So leaving that on the side, the actions have led to an awakening of just the degree of authoritarianism that we've been exposed to. Because although our fans know that we get banned, the kind of human story behind these bans and the cognitive oppression and the ultimate manipulation of the public space into a psyop, that doesn't quite make it to the top of people's mind when we just get banned. But when Elon starts his Twitter files release, it really gives the whole story. And it shows the human beings that were in these emails, talking to each other, knowing that what they were doing was bad, knowing that, oh yeah, can we really claim this? Oh, I'm not sure. Oh, can we truthfully say this? Nah. So they were looking for explanations, and they were looking, how are we going to explain the ugliness of what we're doing to people? The simple fact that they were discussing this is an awakening. It's an awakening also to a possible world in the future where we don't have a new rule every time something happens in society. Because for the last 4 years, it's been far right, ethno-state cannot be mentioned anymore, denials of historical event, and then eventually COVID denialism, and then eventually election denialism. It seems that every time something was looking good on the right-wing side, they would try to smash it down, and they got tempted too far. Now, the COVID discourse is back to be free on Twitter. Some election discussion is allowed that wasn't allowed before. There's an opening, and people realize just how stupid it is to be banning people for opinions in a society that claims to be the most liberal society in the entire history of human civilization.
Well, of course, and you know, you and I know this very well, and you know, I was very upset when I got banned from Twitter in the first place, as everyone will probably remember. It was at the time a rather traumatic thing to think that this account can just be taken from you. That wasn't in keeping with the notion of society that I had at that time. Nowadays, I'm very used to this. You know, I just assume that there is no extension of you. There is your temporary ownership of an account or custodianship of an account that actually belongs to powers beyond your reach, and they might take it from you at any moment. That's my understanding now. Back then, I had this, I guess you could say, 90s liberal sort of idea that
yes.
there was free debate, there was open debate, and things belonged to you, things that you created, and there was general good faith. And anything else was an intrusion on that. It was an exception. It was an anomaly, rather a naive notion. I had really no idea of how powerful. And this goes in general. I mean, and again, it all became very clear with COVID. I had no idea how powerful the forces were that we were up against.
Absolutely.
But at the same
they
time,
they were strong. There's a reason ultimately they give you free stuff, and it's to appropriate some that section of your life. When Gmail gives you free email, it's because there's a way to monetize somehow the control that they will have over your life once they know about each of your emails. And that's been the history of the internet, a display of a kind of unthreatening display of, hey, a service is available that ultimately builds into a PSYOP, and the PSYOP reveals itself sometimes years later. But yeah, I had that 90s view of liberal free market of IDs because they created the illusion of it for many years on the internet, and it existed for real. And the minute they saw they had lost control of it, their true authoritarian nature showed up.
Absolutely. And I've often mentioned this, that in, I think, 2011, 2012, there was a Google conference or something, Silicon Valley conference. And one of the CEOs of Google said that the internet was approaching a state at which it would be uncensorable. Censorship would be impossible on the internet. And he was saying that just a few years before Brexit and Trump, he was saying this as if it was a good thing. You know, at that point, I think Silicon Valley was still fairly dominated by 90s Gen X libertarian, or at least that attitude was still there. And this notion of freedom and the Wild West and democratization, they were always using that term, openness, transparency. and then Trump and Brexit happened. And those two things, obviously Trump was the bigger story there, but Brexit was also very significant, especially on this side of the Atlantic. And that changed everything, I think. After that, they realized we have inadvertently given an enormous amount of power to people who want things that we don't want. So we now have to take that power away from them. And we can, and we will, and we'll get away with it.
But their authoritarian overplay is temporary because the big trend of the internet is toward decentralization. I mean, see how the Odyssey solution rose at the right moment to kind of capture us in a safety net. And eventually it's going to be even more decentralized than Odyssey. Eventually, my dream is to be able to stream from that computer. And that computer serves 1,000 other people, and these 1,000 other people can serve the thousands others that want to connect. There's no stopping this. It's been waves, and sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. But any authoritarian overplay ultimately results in something like the Twitter files and a backlash toward those authoritarians.
Well, two counterarguments to that. And you know, I don't want to burst the bubble. I hope you're right. But two counterarguments are, first of all, nobody cares about the Twitter files. The mainstream media are simply ignoring it, so the public in general won't know about it. And second, Odyssey is being attacked by the SEC in America, who are hoping to, I guess, they're hoping to just completely destroy the operation.
And they got a $22 million judgment, which is twice the amount of the supposed currency that was sold illegally.
And so what does that signify?
Well, the way I see it was, you say people don't care about the Twitter files. I was on the internet when people didn't care about the internet. The internet didn't even exist. I was on BBSs. I was running my own BBSs on voice phone lines that would communicate with modems that you were hearing. Back then, no one was talking about BBSs. And eventually, the BBSs that we were building built into the internet, no one was talking about it. But eventually the normies got attracted to the internet. Right now we're building the alt-tech universe. And here's one thing that you should remember if you want to remain white-pilled about the internet. The number of people on the internet in absolute number is twice what it was a couple of years ago. I wouldn't say the exactly, maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago. So the total mass of people doubles every 4 to 5 years. Those new people that come in, they're more normies than the kind of people you and I are. You and I were attracted to an earlier internet and eventually they wanted to live there. You and I now are attracted to Odyssey and eventually people will want to be an Odysseer. Eventually the children in elementary schools are going to answer to their professors, I want to be an Odyssey streamer. Eventually it's going to be something else than Odyssey. When you're a trailblazer, you are bound to always be part with a subset of popularity, with a subset of the most trailblazing individuals that you're going to carry forward. But what tells me that we're in the right path is that we got the normies 3 steps behind and they're always there. They were there 5 years late on the BBSs. They were there 5 years late on the internet. They were 5 years late on YouTube. They're five years late on Odyssey. And wherever you and I go, we are creating paths for society to develop in the right direction. And through our decision, through what we decide to support and not support, through the fact that we're on Odyssey bringing whatever small audience we can instead of being on Rumble because Rumble sucks, then we are designing the world of the future. We are designing what people eventually will desire. And so be it that they don't desire it now. That's because they're stupid. And I don't even want to be around these people. Fuck them.
All right. So do you, that's a nice optimistic message there. Do you think that the SEC is going to fail at taking Odyssey and Library down?
Oh, they're going to take down the corporate structure. The question is, do the people at Odyssey and at Library, do they have actual balls? When you have actual balls, you know, you have to be willing to survive with a laptop and a luggage case that contains your entire life. And the servers should be outside the US. Hopefully they've already done this and hopefully they're ready to run basically with the data. That is what you have to do to survive on the decentralized internet. If they can do it cleanly and correctly, basically, I say Odyssey and Library will be unaffected by this judgment. I know how they are blackpilled about it because I follow their Telegram and you were on their Telegram recently. I saw your post and I'm looking at them and they're very worried about these decisions. What they have to understand is that if they have built a proper system that is truly isolated from normie economy, their blockchain will continue. Their servers will survive. Their corporate identity might disappear for a moment, but start a new company, call it JF Inc., I don't care. Call it something else. But as long as the data survives, as long as they can't quite get to the server, as long as free speech exists in the US, then you can be in $1 billion debt. It doesn't change anything. Indentured servitude is illegal in the US. They cannot take who you are. They cannot take your body. They cannot take what you carry on your person. These people should continue the Library and Odyssey dream and continue it with whatever they can, whatever they have left. Stop dreaming about being rich about it. Stop creating corporate identities. Be unlocatable. Be part of the blockchain. Be part of the decentralized universe. As long as you can run this site and it can operate and people can connect to it every night, we're going to bring people to it.
All right. Nice. Defiant. I like that. Okay. Then the next thing is, well, is there any more to say about Twitter and Elon Musk? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, just disappointment on the results, but still a white-pilling event because it improves the quality of free speech. It gives us a path, and it shows us really what you can't say still, even under Elon. And we all know what you can't say, and we all notice the people who are banned from Twitter, what is the one issue they care about? It's glowing. It's glowing just how evident it is.
All right. And then that brings us to Fauci. You said that this year he was exposed. And, you know, I have to say, I mean, people have been talking about this since 2020, that this guy is clearly crooked. He's clearly untrustworthy. He's clearly corrupt. It's obvious. He even seems that way. You know, he's one of these people who even seems untrustworthy. It's amazing that he ever got to where he is, but that maybe that's a reflection of the system that he was operating in. And people on our side have been pointing out the contradictions. Just a few, I think it was like a week before the mask recommendation came out, he was emailing people saying that masks don't work, they're not appropriate for this. The guy is something else. And then there's his supposed involvement, alleged involvement with the biolabs, the Wuhan and gain of function research, which could possibly have led to COVID being created. And so who knows? What's your perspective of all of that and then his being exposed this year?
Yeah, Fauci exposed is an old story for us. It's been since the very beginning, the first days he's spoken out, people were after him. What I appreciate from a 2022 perspective is first, there's a lot, the part of the Twitter files I expect will reveal even more how the staff of basically Fauci and the CDC and the NIH somehow were directly involved in censorship of the internet, which is further breach of First Amendment rights by government officials. So I think that there will be a lot of red pilling potential there. But what I mostly retain from the Fauci exposed stuff is that we are in the late COVID propaganda from the government. I mean, you can feel that they're tired. There's basically no one talking about masks and how it should, you should continue wearing masks. And yet, isn't COVID around us still? Shouldn't we be, if it was good a year ago, shouldn't we be wearing masks still today? If it works. So the government propaganda is going down, and the vaccine payouts, the Pfizer and Moderna buying the media, at some point they're not paying anymore. So the media isn't as interested at pushing it as they were. But what I found fascinating is then you get a contrast, because the maniac on Gab that wants to talk about COVID every day and wants to say that Fauci is this crazy guy who kills people with HIV, this guy is still as energetic as he was in 2020, and it keeps coming. What I like is that we are seeing the development of a strand of resistance in human ideology that is willing to work harder than paid government employees, that is going to take the crashing of this system more serious, and they're going to grind longer than the government. And I can't wait for this crew, and it created community. We created Telegram channels with injury, people talking about their injuries from vaccine. We have the whole public database of the VARs. We've basically set a system that I think will smash harder than government propaganda in 5 years, 10 years from now, when the next big pandemic comes and they try to do that authoritarian trick again. I think they're going to find the backlash is getting 10 times harder every time. And the more authoritarian they go about it, the more the backlash prepares itself and builds communities to create instant resistance from the internet the next time they try this bullshit on us.
Yeah, I have a similar feeling that people understand that more of this is coming, more of this is on the way, probably under the rubric of climate change, maybe another disease like COVID, who knows. Now, on the one hand, the powers that be will have learned from COVID. They will have been gathering data on which techniques work, which types of people to target, which types of people are not worth bothering with because they're like you and me, and how to get the message out, they've done all of this. Huge amounts of research has probably been done in the course of the COVID operation, if you want to call it that. But at the same time, the public are now weary of, they're tired of this. I guess the question is, how much will the public take? How much can you push them? Will they become habituated to serfdom? or will they rebel against it? What's your intuition there?
Well, the public generally will converge towards serfdom all the time through history. But what gives me hope is that we're forcing the technocrats into a corner. A corner where their authoritarianism must be done so harsh, and a corner where they're forced to invent a concept like misinformation. That is us forcing those people to come up with these terms and to use censorship. I think that long term, censorship will not be efficacious. So even if they learn from their errors, the problem is that the concepts that they created are fundamentally bogus. The concept of misinformation fundamentally doesn't work in a free society. You have to, it results in impediments on individual liberty inevitably. And so I think that we're actually forcing them into a corner where their learned experiences will not be good. They will be good in terms of targeting the single old person and going to them and convincing them to get the vaccine. But in terms of controlling the public space, I think that the dissident ideas are wonderfully doing in 2022, especially as it relates to COVID. Because these people ultimately have a limited interest in injecting you against your will. You have to understand this, that yes, they are evil technocrats who want to create opportunities for human control, but ultimately they don't give that much of a shit. And ultimately, you look at the US with 60% vaccination rate and people not into the booster thing at all. There's a limit to how much money you could pour onto society to get people to change their behavior in a way that is self-advantageous. And I think we're at that bottom of the resistance of the dissidents that they can't fight through it.
So do you think they're going to have a real struggle to push the climate change agenda?
I think even on this, I'm relatively white-pilled from 2022 because I see so much discourse around of the realization that batteries are, it would be alarming if every human being on Earth had their car battery at £200, £300 each. We're going to run these batteries. We're carrying these batteries around, by the way, which increases the amount of energy you need to power the car. And then what happens when all these batteries go to scrap and we have this flowing in our waters and we have all these substances that we're not really used to recycle and for which there is not necessarily a recycling solution right now? And also the fact that across the years, we haven't seen a massive improvement. We haven't seen an improvement at all in battery technology. The things that power the Tesla is still the same liquids and metals that powered a battery 10 years ago. It's nickel, lithium, that kind of stuff. So the fact that this ever progressivism that exists in people's perception that, oh, it's going to get better. Well, we're 5 years into the electric car experiment and it's not getting better. This may be the best battery we ever get. So I think this will awaken people that, oh yeah, you know, maybe it doesn't make sense in certain places of the US to be burning coal to power electricity generation to charge a battery. Perhaps burning the coal or burning the gasoline inside the car instead of going through kilometers of wires to transport the electricity, perhaps that's better. And I think in many cases, we will find it's better. There will be attacks on private property. We see it in democratic state. It becomes red tape of building permits and controlling every aspect of your house. For sure, there's going to be continued attack using the climate change agenda to ultimately attack the concept of private property and land ownership. But we can escape this. We can go at the edges of society, let the bureaucrats fight within themselves, and the technocrats crash each other's life until, again, we are those republican distant areas from civilization that become the only desirable place to live because the only place where the technocrats haven't fully taken over.
All right. Somebody mentions graphene batteries.
Yeah, I mean, some people have hopes of it, but I don't see a graphene battery-based car available. So there must be some limit I don't see any promising technology for a massive improvement of battery power in the next 50 years. Prove me wrong. I'll be happy. I'll be happy if I see one.
All right. And then the next topic is Alex Jones.
Yes, Alex Jones and John Stewart. Those are my last two topics. I guess we can talk of them together because it goes in the same sense. It was Alex Jones opening to Ye. And the fact that Alex Jones many years ago was refusing to engage with David Duke's argument in an interview, he had David Duke and he was like, no, I want to keep calling them globalist. And it was clear that he was uncomfortable with this subject that David Duke was bringing. We have a reversal where he's been welcoming Ye, he's been laughing, he's been relaxed with it. And just the fact that he's relaxed, even if he wasn't convinced by everything that Ye and Fuentes had to say, at least he's engaging with the point and he's a little more relaxed now that he has trillions of dollars of debt. I guess that will make you not afraid of cancel culture. Once you have nothing against, you become your best self. And that is what happened to Ye. He did it to himself. And that's a little bit what happened with Alex Jones. And John Stewart on the other side, John Stewart is this Jewish comedian who's been having a kind of comedy talk show slash commentary of news. And he is very much respected because he tends to go with the good guy. For example, in the 9/11 survivors thing that he does, he's a militant and activist for firemen and people who have intervened back on 9/11 and who suffer from lung problems because of it. He wants them to get good health care and he's pro-veteran. So he's often seen with the good side, the side that no one wants to go against. His real name, of course, is not Stewart. He's John Lebowitz. But despite his tribal belonging to his own ethnicity, he has found an openness to Ye, the Ye events, and the Dave Chappelle comments in particular. And in 2022, he came out on Colbert and said, we should stop just saying they're anti-Semites and canceling people and they're racist. Let's not engage with them. And we should start saying, all right, let's see what are your IDs and let's stop playing this whole game of you don't exist. That is actually a very beautiful opening from the Jewish side that I've never seen in any Jewish intellectual. Just the acknowledgement that, hey, if it's false, let's debate with them. If it's true, let's hear them. And instead of creating these labyrinths of society where you don't exist anymore, I'm not going to talk to you. It's a total change of strategy that he's suggested. Will it be where podcasts are headed in the media and the social media? Not necessarily. I don't think they have to listen to Jon Stewart. But the simple fact that we have a guy on their side saying, yeah, we're going to have to engage eventually because the cracks are going to show in our system. If we censor that truth too much, if the only people still censored on Twitter are these guys, eventually someone's going to think they must be pretty damn right and they're going to want to hear the arguments. And that's what we want, because if we can create a debate and an interaction opportunity with people who are pro-technocrats, pro-democrats or pro-whatever, we should, because this debate will allow us first to talk to their audience and secondly to also put them in their corner that they truly are in, which is a corner of a kind of drive to authoritarianism, a drive to management of society that to me is foreign to a truly successful European civilization.
Yeah, I agree broadly with that, but I wonder if this is something that I wanted to ask you with the Ye Kanye West story. I forgot to put the question in there. Do you think that the ADL, and I'm guessing you do think this, that the ADL handled it very badly?
They handled it by overreach, which is always what they do. I mean, it's what the ADL has been doing, and it's they overreached in terms of authoritarianism. They will eventually look bad. I think that they're satisfied with their work right now, but long term, by creating this, oh, this one subject, you cannot talk about it in society, but you can think that white people are evil or this or that. All these racist beliefs basically are very often tolerated in society against whites. That ultimately they will pay the price of this, because ultimately when the cracks show, when the system is untenable, when you have the base black people listening to Ye and the base Hispanic listening to Fuentes, they're going to realize that there's been work, active work at hiding the truth. And it's a truth that should be mentionable and should be discussable.
Yeah, I just wonder what John Stewart is going for with this, because on the one hand, yes, all truths should be discussable in an open society and all that, but democratic, whatever. But on the other hand, it's not in his interest, is it, for these things to be discussed? I mean, I wonder how he can think this will benefit me and my group if this is discussed. I mean, do you think it's just that he's reasoned that they just don't have a choice anymore?
There's a lot of hypotheses in my community about this. Some viewers have expressed the idea that this is from Fadam in my Discord server. He thinks that John Stewart, John Lebowitz, is seeing in advance the backlash that will come against his side when it's exposed that there was such an amount of control and lies and censorship, and that they were at the heart of it. And he wants to keep that backlash from happening so that an argument can be made, hey, there were people extending the olive branch on our side. So he wants to soften the backlash, which I believe that he has attained the belief that it's inevitable, that basically our victory is inevitable, in that the truths that we have been caring about, explaining to people about demographics, about management, about technocracy, will eventually be exposed and will be very much hated. They will be very much hated, those people who have stood behind the authoritarian regimes.
Okay, because otherwise, why would he have done this? Why would he have said this?
Yeah, because in other clips, this is the very same guy who says, hey, I think that black people and Jews should ally against whites. And so it's not someone who I put full trust in, but his opening is the beginning of the demonstration of a weakness of the fortress on the other side. And that's also a white pitting thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're correct about this, and I hope you are, obviously. Okay, then we'll get to the... Unless that is all of it. Yeah, I think that is all of the stuff. So yeah. Basically, this has been a year where things have unraveled to some extent, and hypocrisies, dishonesties, scams have been revealed. People have talked about things in a way that they haven't been so open before, especially with Kanye West. And the COVID scam has started to crack. It started to unravel. So it's interesting how far that will go. I also wonder how long the public will be interested in the matter. I hope they will remain, because it was a big deal. I mean, you know, it's starting to feel like the past now. It was 2.5, nearly 3 years ago. And yet I do feel that it changed things, changed life. So it still feels relevant.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we will get to the questions now. And there are quite a few. Maximus Gibbs says... Love you, JF. Stay warm up there.
Absolutely. Nice wood stove.
Ah, yes. Lovely. And some random bloke says, Merry Christmas, Woz and JF. And here in Britain, we are actually 23 minutes away from Christmas Day. So that's something quite nice. Someone else says, okay, yes. Okay, thank you for that. Black Pigeon Pilled says, did David Duke play a role in red pilling you on the JQ, JF?
His zero appearance... role.
Right.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
His appearance on your Shadowband YouTube video was legendary. Much appreciated and Merry Christmas, good Yule.
Alain Soral and Dieudonné introduced the subject of red pilling to me in 2010 to 2014. So that was way before I even knew about David Duke. Eventually, my self-realization that I was going to stand on these subjects on the public space came from a super chat that said, Jeff, you're pointing to a lot of things today in the news that are extremely important, but you are like a blind man walking in the forest. Please get educated on the question of the power of certain communities in our society, and you'll understand what you're talking about much better. And I took it seriously. I did some research and I realized, holy shit, being enlightened on the ethnocentric attitudes of certain groups in our society makes a world that was previously ununderstandable to me. Suddenly, all became extremely easy to explain.
Yeah, I know the kind of thing you mean. It's kind of like it's all a bit baffling and mysterious. Why would a people be destroying themselves? Why is there this strange this nihilism and cynicism? I can understand the nihilism to some extent people gets depressed at the end of its civilization, a low point, and all that. But the ardent determination to destroy themselves and to do things that are just obviously counter to their interests, like mass immigration from the third world, feminism, critical theory, multiculturalism. That's more baffling. You know, it's like a depressed individual can destroy himself, but even then, it's not as efficient as this. Yeah, and
exactly.
Then, and with a group, you'd think that there would be many checks and balances, people and procedures and traditions to guard against group self-destruction. And there are. So therefore, this self-destruction is not entirely self-induced. I would say it's at least 50% other-induced, let's see. Mm-hmm. All right. And then another one. Okay. Text in the box says, I want JF to interview Dr. Tom Cowan.
Okay, I'll check who he is. I don't know.
Okay. Mr. Smith says, 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house, Millennial was streaming at the click of a mouse. Merry Christmas. Well, Merry Christmas to you, Mr. Smith. Thank you for that. All right. Irish Nationalist Media says, Ye wants to represent Christian and Black American interests. Nick wants to represent White American and Christian interests. They respect and are honest with each other. Calling them controlled opposition is just schizo theories. You do not have to like them, but they are honest about their beliefs. Well, there we go. I hope you're right about that. Harold says Merry Christmas, and he says it twice, so thank you for that. Monty Fontaine says Merry Christmas, lads. JF, are you more white-pilled nowadays? You were a bit sad on Millennial a few years ago.
Well, I'm as white-pilled as I was then. But I think that what came from this interview was so many questions. There were so many delusions entertained within the right wing of the internet back then that basically this would be forever expanding, that our success would build and build. And I knew that we were approaching the brick wall collectively. And I wanted to be very insistent on don't delude yourself into a eternal victory. It's not coming. And I still think it's not coming from a controlling our nation perspective. But I am as white-pilled as before because ultimately we can enjoy the world as families and small communities. And I see that ultimately the post-white world will still be a world in which there's place for white people. It's just we're going to be Telegram groups. We're going to be groups of people who get together into the park with our families, with our children. And the world can still be beautiful for us as long as we can isolate ourselves enough from the upcoming disorder. So that's what I thought then, and that's what I still think now. There is still a very big place for an individually led, family-led, community-led white existence.
All right. I hope you're right. Black Pigeon Pilled asks, does JF have any thoughts regarding the polyamory of the FTX insiders? It strikes me as bizarre that hippie fads have become norms within corporate cronyism.
No, I mean, it's exactly what it is. You have to realize that the kind of monogamous nuclear family of the European style is really a European thing. And when you go to the Bahamas with a group of people that are many of them not European, it ends up in this kind of polygamous, bizarre relationship where every betrayal is possible.
Okay, so there were some super chats that I missed, so I apologize for that. Okay, Grief says, Happy Christmas, JF. And then there was Ayas. So Padfa asked the following. JF and Woz, I still recall the stream you both did with Sargon when JF was lamenting the loss of Quebecois culture and Sargon uttered those words, I don't care. That might have been the infamous Warski Spencer stream.
No, no, that was a homemade stream. I remember it was. I was drunk, and you came on. Sargon came on, and it was really just the three of us. Oh. And he said, "I remember that moment."
I don't remember. Yeah. This. How have I forgotten
this? This was the birth of where you can see Sargon ultimately is not a preservationist. He is a classical liberal in the sense that he believes the system of liberalism is optimal for societies, but he doesn't care about preserving the world in a state that it was or it is. He cares about liberalism because he thinks it's a good machine to manage society. Whereas I think that Woz would agree with me, and I certainly do think that we must preserve the world in the way it is, because it's beautiful and it's been beautiful, and there's something to be carried forward from the mere fact that it's in our history, and that this is a safer approach, even from an evolutionary perspective. If the world changes constantly, eventually you reach a world in which you won't survive. But if the world can be kept within parameters that it already was, then you have a chance to survive because the people who were there before you survived.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that wanting to preserve your ethnic group is the most natural thing in the world. It's natural for every other group except for whites. It's natural in the animal world. It used to be natural for whites. So I think it's an affectation when people, or it's learned behavior. It's a learned destructive behavior when people say that they don't care about this. And Padfa continued, and Sargon uttered those words, I don't care. It really nailed it for me where I stand. Thank you all. Thank you for all you've done through the years.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And then let me see what else. Okay. Oh, yes. So, and then Transcendental Titans says, polarized politics is just a battle of competing apocalyptic visions of the future. Great stream and a Merry Christmas to you both.
Polarized very, politics. Very nice expression there. I like to think of it that way. That's beautiful.
It is. And then Monty Fontaine says, if you had to choose Diane Abbott or Caroline Ellison,
who are these people?
Well, Caroline Ellison is the FTX pixie Jewess.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And Diane Abbott is a black low IQ politician in Britain.
I'm going to go with Caroline Ellison, eyes closed.
I would have to echo that. Sounds, yeah, you know what I mean. Okay, anything but Diane Abbott. Except for Nicola Sturgeon. All right. And then Monty Fontaine, which is the more depressing couple to imagine having sex, Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott or Caroline Ellison and SBF? Yeah. The first one, I would say. Okay, some random bloke. Canadian dissidents seem few and far between. Does JF think a collaborative approach would be more constructive? Would he join forces with someone like Dr. Ricardo Deschaine, for example?
Well, you have to understand that the teaming up, the grouping of people is not always valuable. For what we do, I'm an intellectual. Whether my ideas are either good or they're not good. And my ideas are going to penetrate the world or not penetrate it. There's nothing that teaming up really can do. I think people have a lot of delusions about a group can do so many more things. Have you ever operated something in a group with these fucking normies and women just showing up in the coaching room and having their own ideas and trying to put it in their direction? Teaming up is the most disgusting, horrible thing, and it sucks, and you have to make concessions, and eventually you're infiltrated by the FBI. There's nothing that I can see myself doing more efficiently in a group than what I can do on my own. So I'm a lonely guy, I'm an artist, and I'm an intellectual. Now, groups can be useful in politics and making political realizations, and it's good for community building, but those two activities are not what I do.
Yeah, I agree. There are people who are optimized for different things, and content creators tend to be introverts. They tend to be optimized for working on their own, at their own pace, doing the thing that they're good at. And yeah, I mean, it'd be the same with an extrovert. You wouldn't ask an extrovert, okay, sit in a room for 3 months and work on a project on your own, and it's all on you, and you don't really get to socialize much. If you said that to an extrovert, they would be rather depressed about it, to say the least. So you can't, it's a thing. I understand the desire that people have to see content creators that they like, e-celebs that they like, join forces. It's like the Captain America thing, combine their forces in the alchemy. But it doesn't always work like that. And I think you have to, it's a thing. You have to find out, A, who you're good at talking with and working with, which is not the same thing, different things, and B, what can actually realistically be achieved by you working together, because often it's better just to leave people doing what they're doing what they're good at, and they'll produce more stuff. Okay, one from the Honorable Freddie Threepwood. Has, I think this is a joke question, has JF ever wrestled man-to-man with UFC star George St. Pierre?
No, I would love to. I would love him to give me a lesson. I'm a great admirer of him, but I've never seen him personally.
All right. And Black Pigeon Pilled asks you to say the text that I have pasted into the private chat. Could you say that out loud?
Okay. In the public space, we can debate about IDs, but ultimately we must abide by hate speech law.
Thank you. Thank you for that. You were egging, laying on a bit thick there, but it was good anyway. It was good. It's like self-parody. Okay, Night Nation Review says, many of us had a holy shit moment when we found out about the scope of the JQ. And when it's finally understood, most things that seemed confusing all of a sudden are no longer mysterious. That seems very reminiscent of the comment that you read out earlier. But yes, I agree. The video that I always tell people really red-pilled me on this matter is one that I saw, I think, in late 2015. And it's really a remarkable eye-opener. I'll paste it into the live chat now. I'll say incredible eye-opener. And this, you know, up until then, I'd been very skeptical and trying to resist. I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to become that guy. And then someone showed me this video and, you know, that was it. I just couldn't, I couldn't deny it anymore. So there you go. And then there was another one. Oh, yes. Archie says, Merry Christmas from Canada and thanks for Millennial. Well, thank you very much. And that's a very generous donation. So thank you, Archie. Let me just see if there are any others from Entropy. I don't think there are. Okay, so I think I've got through them all. So thank you for all those super chats. This has been more super chats on this stream than any previous one, JF. So
well, I'm happy that despite getting old, I'm still scouring on the internet and still worth it as a guest. I hope I'll be here next year. I've been doing. I'm on a streak, right? Since 2017, I've been on the Millennial.
That's right. Every single year since 2017, that was the first year when it was a sort of big thing. So, yeah, you've been very consistent. Well, I mean, each episode has been different. Each of your appearances has been quite different. But, yeah, it's nice that you're on every year. I think people look forward to it. I certainly do. So
I will always remember the year I came to speak about the revolutionary phenotype. Yeah. Millennial Wells fell asleep.
I didn't fall asleep, but I was extremely tired and struggling to stay awake. It's weird. I think the last 2 years I've worked out how to do Millennial properly. What it is you've got to basically become nocturnal. So you get I wake up at like 5 p.m., 6 p.m. I start at 8 p.m., finish at about 4 a.m., and then go to bed at about 6, 7 a.m. And that's why this year I've been much more awake during all four streams. So that's how to do it. But at first I wasn't as good at doing it that way. So I do apologize. I still feel bad that I served you badly that time.
Well, Merry Christmas to everyone who has been listening. And I'm on a break tonight, so don't look for my show. But if you want to watch my show on an everyday basis, I'm at JFG Tonight on Odyssey.
And you should want to watch his show on an everyday basis because it's very good. As I said at the start, it's nice, it's cozy, it's informative, it's educational, and it's relaxing. So very good stuff. All right, so I will be back in about 10 minutes with Anti-Dem. In the meantime, JF Gary Apey, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. See you soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Bidding on this year's NFT ends on the 30th. It's your chance to own this one-of-a-kind commemorative piece, lovingly hand-coded by Millennial Woes himself. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.